This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, set your phasers to listen. Our guest explores the evolution of the Star Trek TV and movie franchise and how its fan culture set the example for all fan cultures. Now, following the deadly school shooting in Uvalde, Texas last week, families are faced with talking to their children about the school shooting and school safety. Talking about the shooting can be difficult for anyone. Talking about it with kids who might be learning about these types of tragedies for the first time can be even harder. A children's clinical psychologist talks with us today about how to navigate these conversations and what behavioral changes to look out for. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you a parent trying to figure out how to talk to your kid, if to talk to your kid about school shootings? What's been the hardest thing for you? Was your kid the first to approach you? Did you bring it up with them? If you're a teacher at any level, how do you talk to your students? What do they ask you about this kind of news? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Karen Rogers is a clinical psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. She's an associate professor of clinical pediatrics at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
I think one concern parents might have is whether they should talk about these issues at all, if they're just potentially reinforcing fear for the kids by bringing it up. Can you make the case that for many age levels, we do need to have these conversations?
Absolutely. For most age of children, this is something that they've heard about. They've learned it from media or from their peers. And they may have a lot of questions and misinformation that parents can help clear up. And equally importantly, it's very helpful to children to have those conversations with the people who are closest to them and who they trust to take care of them and keep them safe.
I imagine things are going to be very different depending on the age level. But one principle that comes from the National Center for School Crisis and Bereavement at Children's Hospital Los Angeles is that honesty is the best way to talk to our kids about something like a school shooting. Why is that?
Yes. Well, it has to do with trust. You know, a parent or a teacher is a trusted adult in a child's life, and children look to those adults to help them understand and make sense of the world. And you're building a long-term trusting relationship when you have a relationship of honesty with your child, which doesn't mean giving them all kinds of details that they're not prepared to hear, but also not distorting the information that you give to them to, you know, make it sound like it's not a serious problem.
Suppose a child doesn't come to the parent asking about a school shooting or wanting to talk about it. How can a parent figure out that on-ramp into that conversation?
Yeah, it's important for parents to begin this conversation when children don't bring it up. You know, children also often want to protect their parents by avoiding talking about things that they think may be difficult. And children may have seen their parents' emotional reaction in the last week to this terrible news. So it is important for parents to be willing to bring it up. And I find it can be helpful to open that conversation by asking children kind of as experts about kids their age, kids in first grade, kids in middle school. What are they talking about and wondering about what happened?
Let's now move to the earliest end of the age range, kids who might be in preschool or maybe kindergarten, first grade. What are some of the things that we can say to them? What are kind of some of the things we can talk about with them at that age-appropriate level?
Even for preschoolers and kindergartners, it is important to bring this up. Children hear from, if they don't hear from their peers, you know, they hear from older brothers and sisters, and it can be very confusing for young children who don't have life experience to understand something like this. So it is important for adults to open this conversation with children and give them a very brief explanation. You know, there was a terrible thing that happened. A bad person went into a school and hurt many people. And have you heard about that? And what questions do you have? It's helpful to know how to steer a conversation by really letting the child lead with their questions. What is it that you've heard? What is it that you're wondering about? What are you thinking and feeling about this?
When is it right for a parent to say, you know, in response to those questions, I don't know?
Whenever that's the honest answer. I don't know. There are many things about this that we don't know. We don't know how this could happen. We don't know, you know, what led this person to do the things that he did. And we still don't know a lot about exactly what happened. It's important not to give the I don't know answer when children are asking for reassurance. You know, am I safe at school? I think children need to be reassured that they're safe at school, that their teachers and all the adults around them do things every day to make sure that children stay safe. And that while bad things do happen sometimes, those things don't happen very often. They're very, very rare.
Karen Rogers is with us, clinical psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. We're talking about how to talk about school shootings with kids of different age levels. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have an experience to share in having this conversation. How did it go? If you have questions about how to talk to your own kid, or maybe if you work in a school, maybe your students, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Karen, kids, of course, may be disturbed by hearing about this news, but may not be able to express that well what it is that's bothering them. What are things that parents can watch for as warning signs that, hey, maybe they need a little more reassurance?
I think it depends somewhat on the child's age. Young children, when they are confronted with something really stressful or traumatic, often show changes in their behavior. Particularly, they can show what we call developmental regression. That means that a child stops doing things that they were able to do before the stress. They may talk more in baby talk or prefer to play in ways that they played when they were younger. And they can lose other developmental skills like toilet training. So those are signs that a child is experiencing a lot of stress. I would also say a significant change in the child's behavior would be something to watch for. You know, children who are more withdrawn or more irritable or more sad or more clingy, particularly, may be showing signs of increased stress. Then for older children, similarly, you may notice changes in behavior. You may notice more withdrawal, and you may notice more mood changes as well.
It's Brianna, caller at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Manitowoc. Rebecca, hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just listening to the program, and as a parent, I do have two kids in high school and college, so I've been through this whole school shooting thing their whole lives and had to talk to them many times about it. I remember 10 years ago when Sandy Hook happened and they were both in grade school, and the shock and the horror and my kids not wanting to go to school the next day, and me saying exactly what your guest is saying to say, which is it's rare and it's really unlikely to happen. And now 10 years later, I don't believe those words anymore. And I don't think it's responsible to tell our kids that it's rare, because it's not rare. It's actually becoming common. And I really think that we need to discuss what we really need to be telling them, and that is how to protect themselves. And I know it's sad and scary and horrible to think of that we have to teach our children that, but we need to have discussions about what to do if something like that happens, not, oh, don't worry, it's rare. Yeah.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. And Karen, statistically, we know most kids won't go through a school shooting, but I've been there as a parent too. I'm trying to convey a sense of safety to a kid, but I'm worried at the same time, just like Rebecca is.
Yes, absolutely. I think as parents, this is a very distressing thing for us to contemplate, that, you know, we now can count, not on two hands, the number of school shootings that we've experienced in this country. It does remain rare, and it seems to be a growing problem that we are confronted with. I would encourage parents who are feeling particularly frustrated or upset at the pace of school shootings to do what they need to do to take care of their own feelings, and then also to think about how to get involved. What can I do as a parent to make my community and our country safer for children at school?
Rebecca, thanks a lot for calling in. We're talking to Karen Rogers, clinical psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, associate professor of clinical pediatrics at the University of Southern California, with us to talk about school shootings with kids following the most recent mass school shooting in Uvalde, Texas last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a conversation with your kid at some point about school shootings? Have you had that conversation in this last week? What questions do you have about how to answer kids' questions, about how to bring these things up? If you've talked about this in your school, if you're a teacher or work at a school, love to hear how you approach this as well. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Karen Rogers, a clinical psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, with us with some advice on talking to kids about school shootings. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have specific concerns when you're having a conversation with your kid about school shootings that you want to bring up with our guest? Do you have an experience to share having this conversation? Or if you grew up in the last 20 years or so, how did your parents talk to you about these things? What's happening in your schools? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Karen, our caller Rebecca mentioned that, you know, after Sandy Hook, her kids were reluctant to go to school the next day. How do you handle that kind of conversation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, children often have a difficulty taking perspective about how nearby and how frequent these kinds of events are and feel like it's a more immediate threat to them because of the way that they experience the you know, the media coverage, for example, of what happens. And so, again, talking with children about what their specific concerns are is a really important first step. They may be worried about different things than you think. And so asking questions about what is it that makes you feel like you don't want to go to school today? What in particular are you worried about? Can we make a plan to help you stay safe? You know, how can we stay connected while you're at school and I'm elsewhere so that you know that you have my support available to you to help you with this difficult day?
Now, I think a lot of grownups are familiar with the experience when something horrible happens of over following it, exposing ourselves maybe too much via social media or radio or TV or whatever. Can you talk about how to make sure a kid gets a break, especially if they're of an age where they are on things like social media?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Older children often control their own exposure to media now with personal computers and tablets and cell phones. And so it's not as easy for parents to limit that exposure as it is for younger children, where the parents may have more control over their devices and their access. But engaging in a conversation with older teens about the choices that they're making in their media consumption and the impact that it might have. And, you know, being open as an adult, I personally felt like I needed to turn off the coverage for a little while and give myself a break. How about you? Like, what are you feeling about that? What's your experience? You know, sometimes I find I get pulled into reading, you know, or looking at one thing after another about a terrible event that has happened. And it doesn't help me feel better. It makes me feel worse. So I plan breaks. And maybe that's something we could do as a family, to plan to turn off all devices and spend some time talking together or playing a game or going somewhere and being together.
And how about, you know, information gained on, depending on the age, the playground or on the street, monitoring what kind of messages kids are hearing from their peers, some of which might not be rock solid information?
That's right. Yeah. So children who don't get information from trusted adults are getting information somewhere, and that information may not be accurate. This is why it can be really helpful to ask questions like, oh, what are kids in your class talking about? What are you hearing about this? What do you know about what happened? And what other questions do you have? And then when there's a misunderstanding, really providing them with more accurate information.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jane is with us in Madison. Jane, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Jane?
Well, my youngest son is starting his first year in teaching in the fall. So now my concern has moved from him as a student to him as a teacher. Same fear of a shooting in a school, but different now.
And Jane,
so
did you...
how do I...
Yeah, first of all, did you talk to your son about, you know, Sandy Hook and the shootings that happened when he was, what, in middle school or high school?
We did, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Well, Jane, thank you for sharing that. Again, this is maybe more toward the parent side of concern there. What thoughts do you have for Jane as her son starts a career in teaching, Karen?
Yeah, you know, we never used to think that a career in teaching would mean putting yourself in danger. And when an event like this happens, it brings to the forefront our awareness that it's not 100% safe, as nothing that we do is 100% safe. So, you know, having that sort of broader perspective can be very helpful in reminding yourself that, you know, driving to work may be more dangerous than being in a classroom, for example, statistically speaking. And then also, you know, I think your son is making a really important contribution as a teacher, you know, dedicating his career to this field, and a courageous one in an era of school shootings. And like other parents whose children choose careers that may put them sometimes in danger, that can be very difficult to just kind of live with that possibility, and yet also a source of pride in your child and your family and the values that you have shared.
Thanks for that call, Jane. We'll go next to Joe with us in Madison. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Joe?
I guess our own experience at home, our youngest daughter, when she was in middle school a few years ago, she was, I can't remember the school shooting at the time, but she was questioning, you know, if something was to happen at her school. And she said, well, what if I'm in the bathroom at the time, Dad? What do I do? And I'm like, it's a good question. I said, you know, get on top of the toilet, open up the stall door, and be very quiet. You know, I said, make it look like it's empty. I said, I know it's going to be very hard to be quiet, but you need to be quiet. So if the shooter tends to, you know, looks in the bathroom, he'll see it looks like it's empty because the doors are open and nobody, he can't see any legs. But it was scary to talk about that. I mean, you would assume that going to school is safe, but we know now that it's maybe not as safe as we think it is all the time.
Joe, thanks for the call. Karen, answering kids' questions about actual safety procedures in the event that hopefully still unlikely event of a school shooting.
Yeah, I think that the caller's response to his child, giving her concrete, tangible things that she could plan to do, is a really nice way of reassuring her. Feeling like you have the possibility of control when a situation feels like it can be out of control, feeling like you're prepared and you have a plan of what to do, can really help alleviate anxiety for children as well as for adults. So I think that was a really helpful response.
Thanks a lot for sharing that experience, Joe, with us at 800-642-1234. Karen, there are likely some teachers or school administrators out there. Do you have thoughts on dealing with some of these issues in group settings when they come up in the classroom, especially for those younger ages in particular?
Yeah, I think, you know, teachers have a good gauge of how to talk to children, the children in their classroom, like the developmental level and the type of language and the way to frame things. And it can be really helpful for children to have an opportunity to air those, their questions and concerns within a group of their peers with a supportive adult helping them to manage that conversation. And so I think for teachers to provide that opportunity, when it's warranted for kids, just to talk about what they've heard and what questions they have and how they're feeling about it. It's also an opportunity for teachers to help identify a child who might be struggling more with anxiety in the wake of this event.
What kind of resources out there are there for parents or educators, for that matter, to help them have these kind of conversations? I know you at Children's Hospital Los Angeles have a lot online.
Yes, we do. And the National Center for Crisis and Bereavement in Schools has a guide for talking to children when an event like this happens. So I think that there are some nice resources available online. And then if a parent is looking for, you know, more guidance or help, maybe talking with their child's teacher about how things are going for their child at school and what kinds of things they've talked about in the classroom. Talking with other parents they know, you know, a pastor or somebody in their church community who can help them come to this conversation with a, you know, grounding in their faith and their value system also can be helpful.
In just our last minute or so, Karen, can you leave us with just a bit of encouragement for that parent who thinks, I really should be having this conversation, I really don't want to have this conversation?
Yeah, it's very hard to open up a difficult conversation with a child. And I think it's important for parents to remember that it doesn't have to be an extended conversation. But the fact that you're willing to bring up difficult topics with your child tells them something about how they can trust you and what your relationship is like. And so you're helping them in the immediate moment, but you're also building your relationship for the long term.
Karen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. That was Karen Rogers, clinical psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles and an associate professor of clinical pediatrics at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. She shared advice on talking with your child about school shootings, especially following the shooting in Uvalde, Texas last week. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, get a look at the power of prosecutors in Wisconsin's criminal justice system and what happens when that power is misused, with cases from northeastern Wisconsin as part of the central focus. We'll get more from the WPR and Wisconsin Watch podcast, Open and Shut. And you can follow that podcast. Head over to WPR.org. Check out every episode of Open and Shut, plus the latest edition of the Mapped Out podcast. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
James T. Kirk there for the original TV series Star Trek. This is Central Time. A lot has changed for a science fiction franchise that started in the 60s and is still spawning new programs today. And embracing change with all its risks is something that our next guest says has been key to Star Trek's lasting success. And he says it's one of the biggest life lessons Star Trek can teach us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Star Trek in any or all of its versions? All the series, a particular movie? Do you consider yourself a Trekkie? Do others? When did you first get into the show? Which show was it? Do you have a favorite character? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Ryan Britt is the author of Luke Skywalker Can't Read and Other Geeky Truths and writes about Star Trek Weekly for Den of Geek and Inverse. His latest book is called Phasers on Stun, How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. Ryan, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Now, this is a TV show that lasted 3 years or 3 seasons in its original run. A lot of shows have come and gone like that. What is it about the spirit, I guess, of Star Trek that made it last beyond that initial run?
Well, I think that the simple answer is that there had just never been anything like it before. There's kind of a pre-Star Trek pop culture world, and there's a post Star Trek pop culture world. Before Star Trek, you didn't have a science fiction show for adults with continuing characters. And you certainly didn't have one that looked like that. People might snicker at some of the special effects now, but the production design of Star Trek was really something for its time. And, you know, you put that show up against, say, an episode of Doctor Who that aired in 1966. And I love Doctor Who. But you put up just the way that Star Trek is filmed and all the jump cuts and the close-ups and the music and the attention to detail and the costumes. And it, you can really see that it was ahead of its time in how big adventures could be done in science fiction for a mainstream audience. And I think that's the key, that it was really made to be a show that could be for everyone. And yeah, that alone is why it endured, is because it invented itself. It invented a whole genre.
Now, you didn't choose to write a Star Trek book just for the heck of it. You've been a fan, I think, since you were in elementary school. What was your point of entry?
Yeah, my point of entry was, you know, I watched the original series with my mom and dad in reruns and on VHS. I was born in 81. So by the time The Next Generation was coming out in 87, I was six turning seven. And so I was already primed to know what Star Trek was. On top of that, you know, my earliest memory was being excited that LeVar Burton was in Star Trek, because as a child, I was, you know, aware of LeVar Burton from reading Rainbow. You know, I can't imagine what the analogy would be like that for a child today. You know, like, what would that be? I'm not sure. You know, someone from Bluey is on Star Trek or something. You know what I mean? Like, and when I told LeVar Burton that, you know, last year, when I was interviewing him, he was like, well, yeah, I hear that a lot. You know, I'm the gateway drug to Star Trek for kids from the 80s and 90s. So that was my entry.
You got to talk to, in the course of researching this book and your past reporting, a lot of the central figures of Star Trek, including a conversation with William Shatner as your baby was waking up and crying and ready to be fed. And what is it like as a fan, but also as a reporter and author? Do you have that I'm not worthy moment as you come into a conversation like that?
Yeah, it depends. You know what I mean? Like there are actually two Shatner interviews in the book. You know, there's the one at the beginning from 2018, but then, you know, I got to interview him in 2021, right after his space flight. And mm-hmm. that was just kind of luck that happened and worked out. Yeah, you know, sometimes you have a moment where you're really nervous because you realize, even though, you know, as a professional, you interview people all the time, you must know how this goes too, you know, where you're like, sometimes it's sort of like, okay, it's work. I'm interviewing somebody, they're super famous, but you kind of are in the moment, you have to get through it. And then other times you're like, oh boy, I interviewed Patrick Stewart, you know, for Picard season two. I don't think I got anything from the book in there, because I think the book was already out to press in March of this year. But, you know, I told Patrick Stewart on a Zoom call this year that I got into the works of Charles Dickens because of him, you know, and Patrick Stewart looks at me, you know, through the Zoom camera, seemingly into my soul, and is just like, that's very meaningful to me, Ryan, you know, and you're like, oh, my God, you know. So, you know, that was like a 5-minute interview. It was really short. But yeah, I mean, so there are moments where you go, holy wow, I can't believe this is happening. So yeah, but other times it is like, you know, you're in the moment of being a journalist or a writer, and you're kind of trying to get what you need, and try to, you know, be both, you know how it is, mm-hmm. present as a person, but also professional enough to, you know, not, you know, make the interview subject sure. feel like you're going to move in with them.
We're talking to Ryan Britt. His new book is called Phasers on Stun: How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Tim is with us in Avoca. Tim, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your story, Tim?
Basically, I'm 52. I started watching Star Trek. I was on after school when I got home off the school bus. And, man, it just, wow, it's captivating. And I just figured between, like, Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers, Star Trek, it made me a pretty well-rounded person about what was going on in my life, to the fact that my son's name is actually Tiberius. And he wasn't.
Oh, that's great.
After James Tiberius Kirk.
That's cool.
Awesome. Tim, thank you so much for sharing that experience. Ryan, a lot of people, I think, have that lifelong attachment to the show. And part of that, you write in the book that in ways, the heroism, but also the errors and the things that go wrong with characters give us a sort of toolkit for dealing with life lessons in some ways from Star Trek. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, your caller, Tim, just said something funny about, he said Sesame Street, Mr. Yeah. Rogers, and Star Trek. And I think what's interesting about that is, you know, I think I make a joke at certain points in the book that the 60s show was kind of like after school specials written by like 60s stoners, you know, which is kind of true. You know, there was a, you know, Captain Kirk was often, you know, giving big speeches about the way people ought to be. And, we won't kill today, he says in A Taste of Armageddon. That's what makes us, that makes humanity what it is. So I think that there's the allegorical nature and the lessons drawn. But yeah, the Star Trek characters are for the most part adults. And so when adults make mistakes and then sort of figure out their mistakes, I think that that's really empowering to young people. Picard says to Data in Peak Performance is that it is possible to commit no errors and still lose. You know, that's not weakness, that is life. Stuff like that, you know, makes a big impression on you. And then the flip side of that is, Kirk and the Wrath of Khan saying, I don't believe in the no-win scenario, but then sort of being proven through the events of that film that that's a bad attitude, you know, that facing a no-win scenario was important in a way for Captain Kirk was still growing and changing in his 50s and 60s. And I think that's something that not a lot of adventure narratives and heroes narratives do. You tend to say, okay, well, this person is, they've won the day and now let's move on. But with Star Trek, the characters start as adults. And I think that's really, really interesting.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to author Ryan Britt about his new book, Phasers on Stun, How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has Star Trek changed your world? Do you have a lifelong conversation with Star Trek and its various series and movies over the years? Do you have a question for our guest about why things are the way they are in the Star Trek universe? He spent a lot of time investigating that for the book. Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about all things Star Trek with author Ryan Britt. His new book is called Phasers on Stun, How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Kel is with us in Sugar Camp. Kel, hi.
Hi. I just want to say I was about 13 when the first series started, and our whole family would sit down and watch it every week. And what I wanted to say is that I want Gene Roddenberry's future. I think it's the only future that we can really aspire to. And I think that his image of this future that he was projecting is just wonderful.
Kel, thanks a lot for the call. Ryan, can you talk about that vision of the future from Gene Roddenberry and the other key players behind the scenes and on camera?
Yeah, I loved Sarah's heartfelt call. Or I'm sorry, what was the guest, the person I called him? Kel, I love Kel's heartfelt message there. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that what is interesting about all of that is not just like how we all sort of escape into that, right? Like we all sort of escape into that if we love Star Trek. But the interesting thing, I think, is how the shows have managed to say, okay, and then, but how do we keep it? You know, how do we keep it? How do we keep a good positive status quo as good as it can be? There was a great line in a new episode of Strange New Worlds where Dr. Mbenga says that, you know, all humanity became united, but then we got into space and we found new prejudices. And it indicated this idea that even when humanity got together, that then they were discriminated against aliens and that there was still work to be done. So I think that within this sort of hopeful vision of the future, there's also this sense of, like, you know, vigilance, right? Like you have to keep working on yourself. You have to keep making sure that, you know, you're being the best that you can be. And I think that that's something, you know, otherwise there wouldn't be any conflict in the stories, right? Like Star Trek's not a show where people sit around and just are happy. You know, it's an action adventure show. And I think that like, it's an action adventure show with a status quo of hope. And I think that's what Kel, that's what I love what she said so much, is that it's just like, yeah, like this is the future and what they're doing is great. But then when there's problems, they're in a position to solve those problems in a way that, you know, characters in other action adventure narratives are not. It's more, the heroes are inherently a little bit more generous, I guess. And I think that's, when you're a young person, that's a big deal. The idea of these really generous, Mike McMahon, who's the showrunner of Lower Decks, Star Trek Lower Decks, said this great thing that's in the book about how the crew of the Next Generation was like these really responsible adults that felt like they were like, you know, the best sort of like school counselors you could have. And I think there is something to that.
Kel, thanks for that call. Eric joins us now in Hazel Green. Eric, hi.
Hi. I've got two things I just want to say. I saw First Contact in the theater, and when it was revealed who made First Contact, I sat in the theater and I could like almost not breathe because it was so cool. You know, it connected so many things together for me. And the other comment I want to make is I think whoever cast the Kelvin timeline did an incredibly great job.
Eric, thanks for the call. So the revelation about who humankind's first contact had been with historically, it kind of going back in Star Trek history there, how big a moment was that, Ryan?
Well, 96. So 96 was the 30th anniversary of Star Trek at the time. That was the year that First Contact was out. And let's see, I saw it in the theater too. Let's see how old I would have been. let's see, I was 10 in 91. So I was 15. So I remember that really well too. And I remember that moment being sort of shocking. And back then, you know, we didn't have internet and speculation and the trailers didn't give it away. So it was actually a really big moment. I remember a childhood friend of mine named Julie saw it with me, and we had gone to Star Trek conventions together and just looking at each other like, yes, it's the Vulcans. And how, and what's great about his comment is that that film is so hardcore. And like Jonathan Frakes in the book, who directed that film, said to me, you know, that they tried to push Star Trek towards a horror genre with the Borg in First Contact. And yet, even that film that's super scary and dark and has all this horror imagery ends on this extremely upbeat note of the Vulcans showing up and making first contact with humanity. Yeah, I love it. It's one of my favorite films. I have the First Contact soundtrack on CD in my car right now. So I'm with him on that.
Thanks for that call, Eric. We're talking about all things Star Trek with Ryan Britt. His new book is called Phasers on Stun. Back to your calls now. Carrie is with us on the road. Carrie, hello.
Yes, I just have vivid memories of watching Star Trek, the original show, after school and finding it very inappropriate. as a small girl, and I would be clutching my candy necklace and going, "Ooh, he's like such a, you know, well, a lack of a better word, pig." And I just remember being very offended by that as a small child, and I've never really gotten into it. But now with the Big Bang Theory, watching that on repeats and seeing their celebration of everything Star Wars, I think, and Star Trek, I think I can probably go back and revisit that as a you know, nearly 60-year-old woman now. I think I can do that now.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Carrie, I think talking, Ryan, about Kirk's womanizing habits.
Yeah. She's got a point, though, you know, because I am, it's funny because with the original show, I realized, because I have a 5-year-old, that with the original show, I'm like, I got to be a little careful. I got to curate it pretty seriously, because a lot of it is to her point is not super appropriate. But what I would say is that maybe try the newest show, which is called Strange New Worlds, and see how you like it. Because I think that what the newest show has done, what Strange New Worlds has done, is said, here's the flavor of the original series. Here's the kind of like fun camaraderie, go team in space, but it's a contemporary show. You know what I mean? And so it's has a more of a contemporary sensibility. There's an episode that aired today about Spock and his, I won't say who it is, but someone who Spock's very close to, and trying to gain another perspective on somebody's point of view in a very science fiction way. And I think that the subsequent shows, actually, that's where The Next Generation, I think, really shined, is that The Next Generation was a much safer show for the family. And, you know, John Delancey, who played Q, I found a quote from him that I put in the book, that's, you know, that a child, a parent, and a grandparent could all watch The Next Generation. And from most of the episodes, that's true. And, you know, in the original series, yeah, you know, it was an action adventure show for adults. And so it had a lot of things in it that probably are not appropriate now. So I agree with her.
Thanks for that call. Mark is with us in Wauwatosa. Mark, hello.
Yeah, I had to suspend my disbelief about the first series. I was a teenager when I watched it. And Captain Kirk is calling all those shots like he's a submarine commander. Wouldn't the computers have been doing all that in the future? It always bothered me.
Mark, thanks for the call. That's not good, necessarily good drama if the computers do all the shots.
Yeah, and I think that the idea was that they wanted to, you know, if you watch the original series, Kirk is always really suspicious of any kind of automation, you know, like they're always finding a planet where there's like a computer that's taken over and it's masquerading as a god or something like that. You know, he does it a lot, where Kirk unmasks some god that is actually a computer running a culture. So Kirk had a hang up with computers running things, is all I'll say.
Thanks a lot, Mark, for that. Keith joins us now in Marshfield. Keith, hi.
Hi. I'm kind of curious. Why Enterprise? Being a World War II history buff, I've always been kind of curious as to why they called it the Enterprise.
Right, because there's aircraft carrier in real life.
Yeah, well, Roddenberry had a list of names, and Yorktown was the original idea for the ship. But he wanted it to be a ship that carried a name that would have been a World War II ship. Him being a World War II veteran himself, Gene Roddenberry. So I think that they settled on it kind of from a list. And if you go back to the original pitch documents, it was Yorktown for a long time until it became Enterprise. Once they settled on it, there was no turning back.
Keith, thanks for the question. Mike joins us now in Green Lake. Mike, hello.
Hi, great show, great topic. I was a kid of the 60s. In the late 60s, I remember watching Star Trek as a very young boy with my brothers and sisters. And when I grew up, we continued to watch the show. And I liked it so much in the 80s and 90s that I put a lot on VHS tape. And when I got married in 2000 and I had kids, I showed them the VHS tape. So they got to see The Next Generation and Voyager. And my oldest daughter actually really liked Kate Mulgrew in that strong female lead. And now she's in college and she's a leader herself.
Fantastic, Mike. In our last minute or so, Ryan, I think people do look at Star Trek characters as role models in many ways.
Well, you know, Kate Mulgrew's a great example of that because, Representative AOC cites Kate Mulgrew as one of her role models. Kate Mulgrew's Captain Janeway. So I think that that's 100% true. That's just one example, but Stacey Abrams was in the season finale of Star Trek Discovery, and she cites, you know, Picard and Data and a lot of folks from the shows as her sort of inspirations too.
Mike, thanks for the call. And Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Boldly go.
I will. Ryan Britt is an author and writer about all things Star Trek, plus some Star Wars, among other things. He talked to us today about his new book. It's called Phasers on Stun, How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. You can keep sharing your Star Trek stories at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, some states are looking to restrict social media companies from blocking users or content. The U.S. Supreme Court put a temporary hold on one of those laws in Texas. We'll find out what's at stake and what it all means for you. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.